I think the point is, at the end of that lecture, I say, what do we need for health? And the first thing I list is that everybody has to feel included. And everybody has to feel that their lives matter. And people excluded from that feeling suffer in every way. And they suffer 24 hours a day. And it makes a big difference in their health.
Welcome to the Create and Grow podcast. This is Janine Ledford, your host and the creator of the groundbreaking concept of intercultural creativity, which is the intersection of creative thinking and cultural competence. So if you're looking for new, exciting ways to build a positive culture of diversity, equity, inclusion, and belonging that sparks creativity, this is your place. We have exciting guests in all types of fields who highlight how creative thinking best thrives in a culture of diverse collaboration. At the Create and Grow podcast, you'll discover how inclusion drives innovation. Enjoy the show.
Welcome, welcome, welcome to the Create and Grow podcast. I am excited to continue to bring you the top minds of our time, the thought leaders and people who are presenting work and contributing great works of thought and of art and of science, and really supporting this title of intercultural creativity in their own way. Today, I have with me Dr. Peter Sterling. He is a neuroscientist out of the medical school at University of Pennsylvania, and he is a freedom writer. So excited to get into that. And he is an arts advocate and really has an interesting perspective on why the arts are important, a part of a life well lived, and so much more, looking at medicine, at equality, and basically the marriage between social activism, brain science, and medicine. So I'm so excited to bring him to my audience and to just really share his wisdom. Welcome to the Create and Grow podcast, Dr. Sterling.
Thank you, Janine. It's a pleasure to be here. Yeah.
Looking at your work with the advancement of equality and the rights. You were a freedom writer. Can you give us some background about that story?
Sure. This 2021 was the 60th anniversary of that period. And of course, younger people today need to be reminded about what it was about. And so briefly, in 1960, in the spring of 1960, African-American students in North Carolina began sitting in at lunch counters demanding to be served. They were sitting in at what were called 5 and 10 cent store. I guess they're now dollar stores. And they were arrested by a bunch of young white thugs and stuff. But they were following a theme of passive resistance. And they succeeded in spreading a wave of this sort of integrating lunch counters all over the South and the North. And some of the Northern students, including me, organized in their communities. I was at Cornell University. Picket lines at some of these stores, Northern stores. One was Woolworth's. Another was JCPenney's, which I think still exists. And I organized a group of students to run a picket line in the town, small town of Ithaca, with signs supporting the Southern students. And we later raised money. We invited Martin Luther King then to visit, and we raised money for his group. And that was 1960. Well, 1961, a year later, a group of pacifist civil rights people organized the idea of sending a bus, two buses actually, a Greyhound bus and a Trailways bus, from Washington, D.C. south with integrated passengers, white and black, Christian and Jewish, ministers and so on, students. And the idea was to stop at lunch counters along the way, along this interstate highway, to see what would happen. And there was a great deal of planning. They were lawyers. They had bail money. They really were well organized. And they didn't run into too much trouble until they got to South Carolina. And John Lewis was a congressman for many years and died last year. He was exactly my age. And I identified with him my whole life, really. He was taken off the bus and he was beaten in South Carolina. But the bus proceeded until they got to Alabama. And when they reached Anniston, Alabama, there was a mob on the highway and they set the bus on fire. They almost incinerated the people coming off it. They beat them up as they came off the bus to escape. And that photograph has been, it's a classic photograph and been in every newspaper for many years. And at that point, they were in Montgomery, Alabama, and they were hiding out basically in the church of Reverend King, who tried to persuade them to stop because he felt it was too dangerous. They would get killed. But they were very determined. And then there was a group in Nashville where John Lewis had come from. A very important figure was Diane Nash, who was a 20-year-old student, tremendously smart and determined. And Robert Kennedy was calling her to tell her to call this off because it was embarrassing to the Kennedy administration because they were trying to say America is a pillar of democracy compared to the Soviet Union. But pretty clearly, we had some problems. So the decision was made to continue on and to send another bus from Nashville and to continue on to Jackson, Mississippi. And the idea was to have buses from all over the country integrated to go to Jackson and fill the jails. So in late May, I was a junior in college, and I attended a meeting mostly of graduate students to discuss this. And after the discussion, one of the leaders of the group said, well, who wants to go? And I just raised my hand. And so five of us, I called my parents and told them I was going. And my fiance at the time, I was supposed to get married in a month. So I told my professors that I wanted the grade that I had earned so far, and I would see them in September. And a couple of them were very supportive and told me to be careful and stuff like that. And one of them ultimately bailed me out of jail. He was a terrific guy. So we drove down, we got to Louisiana, Alabama, we were crossing the line into Mississippi, and we realized we had New York license plates, and we would probably get stopped by the state police. So one of the guys with us, who was a graduate student in math, was from Texas. And so we put him in the driver's seat, and as soon as we got across the line, we were stopped. Mm-hmm. And the guy said, the trooper said, well, where are you guys going? You're going to make trouble. And he just drawled back. He said, no, we're going to see my mama in Galveston. We're just fine. So we made it to New Orleans, and then we had to find CORE, which is Congress of Racial Equality, which is one of the groups that was organizing these buses. And so we were put up in the Black community, which was illegal. There were miscegenation laws that said Blacks and whites couldn't sleep overnight in the same house. And we were trained in some nonviolent methods. And after 2 days, and we took a train because the FBI at this point wanted to keep people from getting killed. And they knew that there was a mob waiting on the highway for this bus. So we snuck into Jackson on this train and got off the train in an integrated group, looked for the lunch counter, and we were arrested immediately. And the point is that over the summer, they did fill it. We did fill the jails. Mm-hmm. And by late summer, the Kennedy administration, the Interstate Commerce Commission, ruled that, yeah, that's it. That was, thank you.
I'm showing a picture of Dr. Sterling right now. This is your mugshot, correct?
That's my mugshot, yeah. May 30th, 1961.
Wow.
The thing is that this action was completely successful. And by the fall, interstate travel was integrated for once and for all. And students had done it. It was a really powerful message to students that saying, if you act, if you put yourself on the line and do it well, you can make a difference. And that was a really good thing to kick off the 1960s with.
Wow. And thank you so much for that. Thank you so much for raising your hand, because it's easy. The work that I'm looking at is just how's the brain functioning with intercultural experiences, but also with creativity experiences. So I've been looking into the work of Dr. Lisa Feldman Barrett and looking at allostasis, which we're about to talk about, but how for the brain to really go into some cultural competence areas of doing things that it doesn't really know the outcome of, whether it's creative things or making connections with people with different lived experiences, it's a higher energy cost. There's more work that the brain has to be done to try to predict. And I know so much about this. So I just wanted to start off with your story of Freedom Writings. First of all, just to give everyone an idea and to pay tribute to your work, to the freedoms and the life that I live with ease and with joy, with not even understanding what you and your generation and my parents' generation and my grandparents' generation had to do so that I may have a lot of the freedoms that I enjoy. So I give you thanks and gratitude and honor for you, and thank you for serving. And so going into the medical aspect of it or the neuroscience of it. First of all, let's really clear up allostasis and home homeostasis, because I want that to be the basis of our talk as we kind of get into intercultural creativity, what's going on internally, externally, and how this equates to equality and inclusion. What is allostasis and how is it a little bit different than homeostasis?
So look, I will answer that. But I think I should do it in a slightly different order, okay?
Okay, go for it.
The idea of how the body is regulated, the blood pressure, the heart rate, blood glucose, fatty acids, all of this stuff, had been taught and still is taught as the idea of homeostasis, which is everything in the body should be maintained constant. And every time, like the temperature of a house by a thermostat. And when the temperature drops in your house, there's a switch that turns on the heat and warms it back up. If it gets too hot, it shuts it off. And the idea is that there's a set point for each parameter in the body that regulates it. And this is still taught in medical schools, has been for, well, ever since I arrived, probably for about 100 years. And the thing is, when I went to graduate school after the Freedom Rides, I was still working in the Black community in a ghetto in Cleveland. Black people and African Americans were crowded into two major central ghettos, could not live outside the city, and they still can't. I mean, it's still a segregated city. And I was knocking on doors in this ghetto called Central, and I found, and I was sneaking away from my lab because my advisor was a hard-driving guy, and he wanted me at my microscope, but I just left. What I noticed was that many people who came to the door were limping. They were using a cane, their face was sagging, their speech was slurred. And I went back to my advisor. I said, what is this? He said, well, those people have had a stroke, which is a damage to the brain in the very part of the brain that we were studying. Mm-hmm. And he said it's caused often by hypertension, high blood pressure, which I'd never seen in my community. And then I got to thinking, well, my grandfather was an immigrant from Russia, and he was Jewish, and he was confined to that very ghetto in Cleveland. It was a Jewish ghetto then. He was a house painter. And he had an early stroke. He had hypertension. He had an early stroke. And I thought, well, gosh, maybe hypertension is related to social tension and stress. So I finished my thesis. I went on to postdoctoral work at Harvard. And then when I started my own lab, I met a guy, a young guy named Joseph Iyer and his wife. And we were thinking about social aspects of medicine. They were. And Joe pointed out to me that hunter-gatherers don't have hypertension, they don't have cardiovascular disease, and they have a much lower stress life, and we should pay attention to that. And so I began to study, I was studying very fine detailed neural connections in my laboratory, but I began to study in the library what's going on. And I found very quickly that there were lots of brain connections to all of the internal organs that control blood, that control the kidney, that pumps salt water into the bloodstream to make the blood volume high. It controls the heart rate. It controls the blood vessel constrictions. And all of these things raise the pressure and they lower it. So there was a sort of a smoking gun. Then I saw that I found a recording, a 24-hour recording in one individual of his blood pressure, the guy had put a cannula in one of his arteries. And he walked around and he recorded the pressure of 24 hours. And it's amazing. It shows it's going up and down. It's not that you don't have a blood pressure. You know, people say, my blood pressure is something. It's going up and down all the time, mm-hmm. hugely. And so the record shows, when he's dozing in lecture, it goes down. When he's stuck with the pen, it goes up. When he has sex at midnight, it goes way high. Then it comes crashing down while he sleeps. And I realized, this is the brain predicting what's needed and adjusting everything. And it turned out that this is true not just for blood pressure, but for your blood glucose and all your hormones and everything. So with Joseph Iyer, we began to write papers about this, about how society gives us social stress and it causes these problems. We published the first one in 1977. And a radical journal of political economics, not a mainstream journal. Mm-hmm. The next time, and I began to work seriously on the underlying biology, And we wrote another paper and published it in 1981 in a more significant journal called The Biological Basis of Stress-Related Mortality. And it really laid out with footnotes, hundreds and hundreds of footnotes, it's a long paper, about the neural basis for physiological control. And I began to talk about this throughout the course at Penn, and then nothing much happened. So we got invited to write a review article in 1988 to summarize for a book on stress. Joe and I wrote the article. And at the end, I said, Joe, what we want to do is convince people that it's the brain in charge. And so when they tell Black people, oh, no, there's something wrong with your body or your genes or your salt, it's wrong. It's their brain that's getting messed up by what's going on. And we need a name to differentiate this idea from homeostasis, which is the standard idea. I now consider homeostasis is actually a sort of a racist doctrine, really, because it tells people, no, it's your body that's messed up and nothing to do with the oppression that you suffer. And whereas what's actually going on is the reverse. So I asked a friend of mine who was a professor of Greek philosophy what word we should use to go up against homeostasis. And I explained to him that the idea was homeostasis was about constancy, holding everything constant by negative feedback corrections. And we were seeing is that the brain was predicting what would be needed, and it was varying. It's not, the body's not constant. Your temperature goes up and down, your pressure goes up and down. And so we wanted a stability of the body through change. And allostasis stands for stability through change. So that's the origin of the idea. And one is all about negative feedback, like a thermostat, and the other is the brain thinking about what's going on, understanding the context, and controlling the body.
And with the work of, do you know who Dr. Lisa Feldman Barrett is? Have you seen her
work? Sure.
Okay. Yeah. Yes. I just finished one of her books called 7.5 Lessons of the Brain, and she actually talks about allostasis. So it seems like you and your partner were one of the first ones to really present this term to the medical field. Is that?
Yes. Oh, wow. She's picked up the idea and run with it very successfully, and I try to help her and cheer her on. Yeah.
Definitely. Wonderful. So it's another honor to meet you because you're another originator. But it was fascinating to read some of her work of just how the brain is such a predictive organ. And so we are trying to figure out how much energy to put in places. So could you talk to how being in oppressive or toxic environments, how that affects the brain's ability to produce, to create, to connect with one another?
Sure. The early idea, which was developed in about 100 years ago, was by a physiologist named Walter Cannon. And he was at Harvard Medical School. And he was a very famous and good scientist. And he coined the word homeostasis. But he also understood that there were emergencies that we would face. And he coined the term fight or flight. There are times when we either have to stand and fight or run like hell. And when that happens, he noticed that our adrenal glands pump out adrenaline and our heart rate goes up and our breathing rate goes up, our blood glucose rises. And he understood that there were neural mechanisms to mobilize energy. And this is perfectly true. And so that's what makes you be able to run faster when you're frightened or hit harder when you're defending yourself. And the only problem is that he didn't acknowledge or even didn't realize at the time that this was part of a continuum of regulation, that when the emergency is over, the brain settles back everything back down and there's a time for rebuilding. It's also true every night when we go to sleep, our metabolism changes drastically. Our blood pressure goes down. The electrical channels in our heart swap out a high rate channel for a low rate channel. When dawn comes, it goes back the opposite. Our liver metabolism changes. And sleep is a restorative process where we resynthesize the stuff. Our wounds are repaired and stuff like that. And Canon didn't see this as part of a regular, total regulation system. And so getting back to your question, what does stress do? Well, there's a role for stress, and because it makes us alert and tunes everything up. But if it's chronic, what it means is that your body is chronically breaking down stuff for energy and it's not repairing stuff. And it messes up your sleep. We have our brain has a clock, literally a clock in it that tells you when it's time to eat and what time of day it is and when it's time to sleep. And if you mess with that, you're really in trouble. So that's the thing, that social stress and chronic fear, somebody has to think every time they see a police, this really messes with their whole body and their immune system and their cardiovascular system. So that's really the issue.
And one of your lectures that I saw really looked at how blood pressure responds to mental state. And so if people are in, because a lot of my work deals with organizations or companies that are working on their leadership and their culture to make sure there is more inclusiveness, there is more state of belonging. And you had a list that said health is belonging. Could you talk a little bit about
that? Yeah, well, I should have made that list myself. I think the point is, at the end of that lecture, I say, what do we need for health? And the first thing I list is that everybody has to feel included. And everybody has to feel that their lives matter. And people excluded from that feeling suffer in every way. And they suffer 24 hours a day. And it makes a big difference in their health. The other thing I point out, I think, in that list is that for 200,000 years from the origin of our species, most of that time was spent gathering food and hunting. And that turns out to be, modern anthropologists study hunter-gatherers. There's still some left. I'm talking to you from Panama. There's still people who live there that way. And I visited them various times. And it turns out that when you can't go to a grocery store, Whole Foods, and you have to actually collect the plants and the roots and the animals that you're going to eat, it's very tough. It's hard work. And children in these societies don't start until they're 20. So by that time, their bodies are, you know, pretty bit mature. But that's when they apprentice themselves to the older people in the community. It's just like going to college. Mm-hmm. And the thing is, you'd think that, oh, you pick the low-hanging fruit or you shoot a rabbit, no problem. But what happens is that to really get good and productive at this activities, it takes 25 years. And people who are doing this sort of work don't reach their maximum productivity until their middle, late 40s. And then they can continue it on into their 60s. So people in these communities who are 40 and 45 and so on are grandparents. So what it turns out is that in these societies, two things: to take care of a child who's just sucking up calories from birth to childhood to adolescence, just eating, not doing a darn thing to support themselves until they're 20, there's two generations that are supporting that. And if only one generation did it, or a single mother had to do it, it's almost impossible. And you would have to have very long spacings between children to be able to take care of one. And it's not only difficult calorically, nutritionally, it's difficult emotionally to do, because with big brains, we're demanding. So what happened was that for 200,000 years, we had these very interesting jobs that we were learning all the time, how to do this, how to do that. What's a good choice? Should I go after a pig this afternoon or just a rabbit? It's more likely to get a rabbit. Pig is better. These are decisions that are learned over decades. And now what happens? Well, many people are forced into jobs, if they can get them, that they learn in 5 minutes, to scan a barcode, stamp a passport, stuff like this. And I do say often in my lectures, that's the sort of work that you learn in minutes that isn't really fit for a human brain as big as ours. And the only way you can do those over the long run is to be stoned, really. And so that's what happens. I don't think it's any accident that the laws in the U.S. at this point are changing to permit more marijuana, because it makes life more tolerable to a lot of people.
So if I can jump in, so what I hear you saying, what I heard from your lecture is that our brains are meant to create. Our brains are meant to be met with challenging activities and to be thinking about just different ways of solving problems. And as the other doctor's work says, that we have social brains, that our brains are meant to socially connect with other brains in order to solve these problems. But a lot of us might be in jobs that are very not asking the level of expertise or just geniuses that we could be offering to the world. Yes?
Absolutely. That's exactly right. And when you can't do it, it's disturbing. It's like a life sentence to a boredom and poor pay, and lack of control over your life. You have to answer to some boss who doesn't give a damn about you. That isn't the way we evolved. And it's creating a lot of problems.
Is this why you think that there's a big push on the term like purpose or organizations making sure that their people understand purpose of their organization, purpose within their own life? There's this huge, I feel like we're in this huge shift right now because of the pandemic, but also just the time that we're in, that people are starting to reevaluate what's really important in life.
Yeah, I think so. And I mean, I think that's a positive aspect of business culture. I hope that continues. So one of the things that happened was, the generation before me, my parents, were in unions. And the unions, the Auto Workers Union was organized in the 1930s, the mine workers unions, electrical workers. And so my generation grew up, the working people in my generation who didn't go to college, they were in these strong unions that had been created by their parents. And it meant that there was a limit to what these bosses could do, and there were vacations, and there were time off, and there were retirements, there were all kinds of benefits that were available, and now that has pretty much been destroyed, and they're just now beginning to organize. Starbucks and Amazon and these other places are going to have to get unions to give the workers back some power that they had once and they lost.
The concept of wellness has been taking a lot of ground in the past 10 years. But now we're looking at the World Economic Forum said that creative thinking, innovative creative thinking is now the number one skill needed in the workforce. But what does that mean as far as wellness and people understanding purpose and people in challenging activities that really, so it's all tied, it's all connected. And I definitely want to get to the aspect, something that really made you jump out to me when I read the article that you and Dr. Michael Platt wrote together about despair and a lot of the issues that our country is facing now. But you brought up the aspect of art. And you also talk about art in your lectures. I want to read something that you wrote from the article that I'm referencing. You said, devoting time to such non-economic activities is crucial for brain development and ultimate well-being. Part of our human evolution and allowing people to develop intellectual intelligence was to devote a lot of the brain to the arts. People used to have that time. Now in the US, we're not given any time off or any time to think, and we're not given any paid vacations. People can't afford them, and this is affecting it. So why are the arts important just because we're human, but also important as far as us thinking well and being well and feeling well?
Sure. So I start from biology. And to a biologist, we understand that evolution developed organs and skills and connections basically to help us pass our genes on to the next generation. And so what it means is that if a brain invested a lot of territory and connections and energy into art, painting, music, dance, sculpture, any of these things, it must mean that it has something to do with our ability to go forward as a species. And so in my book, which maybe this is the time to show it, this is my What is Health? It came out, whoops, yeah.
With a beautiful picture on it, by the way.
So what is that picture, okay? That picture is a painting of hands in a cave by very early human beings in Indonesia from 44,000 years ago.
Okay? Wow.
So what it means is we didn't leave Africa as a species until about 50,000 years ago. And when we did, we zoomed up and got to Asia, got Indonesia as an island. We must have built boats with stone tools and gotten to Indonesia. And the first thing that people do when they get to a place, they find a cave, is they do these paintings. And these paintings are actually, if you look at them, highly skilled paintings. And actually, that painting, they always paint hands. That painting is from a cave in southern Argentina, actually, from 11,000 years ago. And that's when people first got to that place. And it's called in Spanish, La Cueva de los Manos, the cave of the hands. But in Indonesia, they paint the same hands. And these paintings are very skilled. And so it's not like the show in the cartoons of a caveman, you know, with a skin, you know, doing some stick drawing. These are really skilled drawings. They're made by grinding up pigments and then taking a bone, an animal bone that's hollow, and they would hold up their hand like a stencil. And then they would blow the pigment there over the hand and it would leave this impression. So this was done early. There are bone flutes from 40,000 years ago. We were making music way then. So why did the brain evolve to do this? And my answer is, it's in my book in more detail, is that we have only about a one and a half liters of space in our skull. And our cerebral cortex specializes to make use of that space. It generates about 200 different like local circuits and that do different things. And so there's visual circuits, there are auditory circuits, there are language circuits, motor circuits, and so on. And so an individual, you know, that's all we have to work with. And so our intelligence is better than a chimpanzee. Our brain is 3.5 times bigger. But at a certain point, there's no more space and you can't develop anything. If you're a painter or say a musician and you spend hours a day fingering stuff, the area of your motor cortex that controls your fingers gets bigger. And if you stop doing it, it shrinks back down. If you're a taxi driver and you learn all of the streets in London, people have studied this.
Yes, I've seen that study.
Your area of your brain that has a map expands. Other things contract. When you retire, it goes back. These areas, if you want to have a community that's smarter than the individual, you need to have each person have a little bit different brain. And so there are people in every community is a couple of percent of the people don't have the areas to recognize these faces. They just don't. And other area people really are insensitive to music. Other people are super recognizers for faces, and they're super good at music. I mean, Mozart, you know, was composing symphonies when he was five. So everybody gets a little bit of a different innate talent. And what happens when you get an innate talent is that you practice it because that's rewarding. That's what's fun. And you learn quickly. Oh, boy, that's great. So the kids in my school growing up who were good at sports, baseball, they just played and played and played. And they didn't even want me on the team, really. I wasn't good enough. And so it's a tragedy because we all have these different talents and every one of them should be developed. And so what has this got to do with art? Well, if you have a community where we can share, some people can build a boat, other people can fish, other people can find their way home. They have to get along. And the way we get along is through art and music, because that is what draws us together and gives us, we tell stories, we tell jokes, and it allows us to reduce our own individual loneliness and to build a community and to reduce our aggressiveness and to relax.
Awesome, awesome. And so the term that I saw that you used was communal intelligence. So everyone realizing that your brain is different. I looked at a meta-analysis of a bunch of neuroscience research papers, and they had basically five findings. Culture is important, but one of them was every brain is different and looking to see where the assets are. I know for as K-12, we're looking more towards leaning towards asset-based learning of having the student understand, okay, well, where am I strong at? Where do I shine? And how can I utilize that? Can you speak to that a little bit?
Yeah, I mean, to put 35 kids who have all these diverse talents and who lack other talents, because that's the way we're built, and together and telling them to pay attention for an hour and not to move is a pretty not only crazy, but it's very destructive. So there are some kids that are very good at sitting still, and they're very good at paying attention to the teacher. My son was better at paying attention to what was in his head, and he was not good. He was no way he was going to pay attention to the teacher. So he was stigmatized as, but he was funny. He would knock his books, stack books onto the floor, and all the kids would laugh, and the teacher would throw him out of school. So at a certain point, I realized, I mean, he went to very good schools. I mean, where the teachers should have been better able to deal with this, but they weren't. So he didn't have a good experience. But what he ended up with out in Hollywood, he became a comedy writer. And he had done recorded phone pranks, prank phone calls and stuff like that, and got good at that kind of stuff. And I knew some of them. Later, he worked for South Park first for a while. And he worked with a woman named Sarah Silverman, who was a comedian, and he ran her show for a while. And he told me, he said, "Dad, I had these tape recordings from when I was 11 and from prank phone calls. And Sarah's playing them in her nightclub act in Nevada, in Las Vegas." I said, "Oh, great, Dan. I'd like to hear them." And he said, "No, Dad. No, you can't hear these." So the point is that he found his way when he was in high school, and he would have failed chemistry. And I made him take chemistry. I persuaded him to take chemistry. He was okay, but he didn't like it, so he didn't study it. And he would not have passed if the teacher didn't know me and so on. But I gave him a video camera at that point, and he was off. He was making his own videos and writing his own stuff. And that's what kids need. They need to find what they can do, and they should be helped to learn the basic things. Everybody needs to read and know how to add and stuff like that. But there's no reason to torture kids in solid geometry who have no interest in it. I mean, that's crazy. So that's my story, would be to reorganize education, to try to have, rather than one size fits all, to have many sizes which are needed.
Yes, yes. But being a teacher, it is extremely difficult. But I believe it's what we need now as we are in the middle of the shift, that people are paying attention and hopefully open to change. It reminds me of some of Gardner's work of these multiple intelligences. And
absolutely, absolutely. I didn't invent this. This is, Howard Gardner's been a big contributor to this. Yeah.
Yes, yeah. Yes. And now, but the beauty is that now the neuroscience is adding some more punch to it. We're adding some more just evidence about what's going on in the brain when the kinesthetic aspect or the musical aspect or the nature, there's a natural aspect. People who are just highly connected to nature, but I believe as human beings, we all should be highly connected to nature. But I think the question is celebrating it. It's not that people aren't acknowledging that people have intelligences, but some are celebrated and some are not. Some are just dismissed. And I was a music educator for predominantly most of my in classroom experience. And when the budgets get cut, the music and the arts are the first to go. And it seems like we're always labeled as like the extracurricular activities, when I believe now the research is showing that these parts of life are just as important as the logical, the numerical, and so on and so forth. So wonderful. Well, thank you so much. We do like to end with a last gem. My logo is the diamond. So we believe everyone should shine bright, and we're multifaceted and all of the other metaphorical lessons that we can pull from the diamond. But if you were going to leave us with one last gem about your work before we let people know where they can go find your book and everything, what would that gem be?
Well, before, maybe one last second, there's still such a racial divide in the U.S. that if we could get white people to stop and think for one moment or imagine a day with only white music that had no African-American influence and no Latin influence, I think it would be silent. And I think that's a level of art that people just don't ever stop to think, give thanks for. And it would be a very interesting experiment. I don't know. I just like to see people take care of each other. I'm very disturbed at the condition of the United States now. And I'm pretty old and I can't do much pounding the streets anymore, but I am trying to give lecture, talk to people like you to get the word out. I spoke yesterday at the University of Texas in Houston to a class of MD, PhD students. They're getting an MD and a PhD. They're very smart. They're very able. And they were very diverse. I mean, I could see all kinds of faces there. And I gave my standard talk that you've seen. And it was very well received. And I think people at my age have some power to inspire people. And that's really what I would like to do, is that people see that you can make things better. And they always ask me, and they did yesterday, "Well, how did you manage?" And my answer is, it's very hard. You have to get help. You have to find help when you need help. And I wasn't, my life wasn't smooth, but I was lucky and I did find help. And so that's what I think people understand. You have to keep at it, really. That's it.
Awesome. Awesome. Well, thank you so much for your time. If people wanted to find more about your work, we'll have some links in our show notes where the book is, but is there any particular place that you would like to direct them to?
Well, I have a Twitter at whatishealth21, and it's on my link, my email. And I actually try to tweet pretty regularly, making comments on what's going on in the world, trying to say some positive things, some negative things, and it's sort of entertaining. I don't know how useful it is, but it has put me in touch with a lot of people who I might not have met otherwise. And I'm very glad to have worked with Michael Platt, who's my daughter's age. And he came to Penn after I left, but I knew his work. And I reached out to him and asked if he would join in this project. And so it's been a very uplifting thing. He's a terrific guy and doing really good work.
Wonderful, wonderful. Well, thank you so much for joining us. Thank you to our amazing audience for being here. I just hope you feel inspired by someone who is dedicating his entire life from the Freedom Rides, from before that to now, and shows how intercultural creativity is a developmental contribution and that you can be developing and contributing at every stage of your life. And as your work says, having that challenge activity at every stage of your life is key. So thank you so much for joining us.
I think you do this very well. And I thank you for having me and keep going. This is good.
Well, thank you so much for joining us on the Create and Grow Rich podcast. And to everyone else, please continue to live a life of intercultural connection and intercultural creativity. We'll see you next time. Bye-bye.
Thank you so much for joining us at the Create and Grow podcast. We hope that you obtain some amazing gems and are able to see how you are creative and how we are more creative when we work well together. If you wish to learn more about our organizational training programs and professional development for companies, organizations, schools, and districts, visit cafestrategies.com. That's C-A-F-F-E strategies.com, where we have amazing keynote speakers and certified facilitators on board to help your organization learn how to build a climate of inclusion and innovation. We have groundbreaking book titles in our online bookstore that lay out the 7 gems of intercultural creativity, as well as our children's books that inspire the innate creative ability of our little ones. We thank you again for joining us and remind you to shine bright like a diamond. See you next time.